I don't know if you want me to save this for when we're live here, but I'll.
Yeah, yeah, maybe, maybe. I don't want to.
Let me just say this. Yeah. My internal guts, and I mean not the spiritual gut, but
the intestines.
My actual intestine. I am so nerved out.
Yeah.
This week. Yeah. I've never had a physical reaction like this. I think all the inner stuff in us, we're feeling it physically because we know the precipice that we're all on.
We are witnessing America as a failed social experiment.
How do we tell this story in a way that builds the kind of emotional momentum that colorblind ideology builds?
So many young brothers and sisters of the younger generation find themselves so far removed from the best of their past.
What are we going to make out of the nothing we've been given? How do you envision possibility?
Hey, everybody. Welcome to The Tightrope. We have a very special guest today. It's our first return guest. It's Michael Moore, the formidable and amazing Michael Moore. Thank you so much for joining us on The Tightrope again, especially now, given all that's going on. Welcome to The Tightrope, Michael.
Well, I'm honored to be asked back and to be here on this day, hours before. We're going to find out. We won't find out tomorrow, probably, but there's still time for us to get some of the 80 million non-voters out there, the people that have rightfully given up because they can't take it anymore. And I think if we had more empathy for them, instead of vote shaming them or wagging our fingers at them, they might listen. You know, I mean, my pitch to them has been, I get it. The fact that you don't vote, it's got to kill you. Cause I know you love this country, and I know that to sit it out on election day is just got to be crazy, because you're one of the quarterbacks of our democracy, and it's the Super Bowl. And you've decided, as an act of almost civil disobedience, to not participate, to have a sit down strike in your house. And I admire you for that. I really do. But this one time, you understand that I and a lot of other people agree with you. Join us this one time. You know, I reach my hand out to you, and I promise you, if this doesn't work, if Biden gets in there and it's just, you're still drinking poison water in Flint, I get it.
Yeah.
I will not come to you again for this. I've used up my one chance. I thought it was worth it. I couldn't completely trust. That's how I can't tell anybody this is definitely going to happen. I mean, I think I can promise you that Joe Biden is going to re-up us on the Paris Accords, all right, the climate accords. But that's not fixing that corroded lead-filled pipe from the middle of the street into your home.
Yeah, yeah, no, for sure.
Brother, we thank you for being the first person and the first voice on this tightrope going back to early summer.
Yes,
and in one of the grimmest moments in the history of the nation, one of the bleakest moments in the history of the empire, we've got one of the lights, one of the blessed forces for good. We have got a truth teller, a justice seeker, and a wounded healer who's trying to keep track of possibility. Where are we now, my brother? What is your characterization at this moment?
Well, in terms of the horse race, I think that we are caught between feast and famine right now, today, to the point where this could go, when they finally are able to count all the votes, which is going to take a week and maybe two. So get ready for this. Trump is going to try to shut the vote off midnight tomorrow night. So we've got to make sure that doesn't happen, because he does not want all the votes counted, for a good reason. Because we know, just like 4 years ago, the popular, what we call the popular vote, which means the people do not want him in the White House. They said that loud and clear, with a 3 million vote difference between him and Hillary 4 years ago. But nobody mentions, I think it was like the 5 to 7 million other votes, the third party votes. Those people didn't want him either. So that means there was anywhere between 7 and 10 million Americans that said no to Trump. That's a landslide against him. And so I believe the same thing will happen this week that the American people will speak with a loud and clear voice, Trump removal. No doubt about that. But we have a slave era electoral college system that was set up to placate the Southern states and let them count slaves as 3/5 of a human so that they could boost the numbers in their congressional districts so they'd have a larger say, both in Congress and in the Electoral College. It is stunning that we are still talking about the Electoral College. And I want everybody to make a pledge that one of our first jobs here has to be, this is the last time that we're going to have an Electoral College. It's got to go. So I think it's very possible that there could be a tsunami of votes against Trump this week, and he will be buried in this landslide of ballots. I also think, because I think Trump is an evil genius, and we focus a lot on the evil part. We don't talk too much about the genius because we don't like reminding ourselves how we were outsmarted. He outsmarted us in 16, and some of him didn't even know he was outsmarting us. But he did, and we have to admit it, right? The first step of the 12-step program is admitting that you've got a problem here. And we, the Democratic Party, 4 years ago, the Clinton campaign, 20 years ago, the Gore campaign, have a problem. Because something is seriously wrong when in 6 of the last 7 presidential elections, the American people have gone to the polls and said, we don't want Republicans. In other words, we don't want the racists and the bigots and the misogynists and the people that support Wall Street. We want the Democrats in whatever form they're coming in. That's our other choice. So we want them. 6 of the last 7. Do you realize this is now, what, 32 years since H.W. Bush was elected? In that time, in those 32 years, only once have the American people said, we want the Republicans in there. And that was during a war in 04 and by only one state. W won by one state, 100,000, 150,000 votes. That's it. The American people have been speaking with one voice now for 32 years. So, and what this means, if you're watching or listening to this, if you're 30 years old, you really haven't known anything other than you live in a country where the people want the Democrats. And yet we hold virtually no power. I don't have the number right here, but it's around, I think there's 12 states maybe, where Democrats have the governor and both houses in the state legislature. 12. We don't have the Supreme Court. We don't have the Senate. We don't have the White House. You go down this whole list. The American people have said they want us in charge, and yet we're not in charge. So is this a democracy? And I get why a lot of people check out. They don't vote. I mean, what's the point? If for 32 years, other than one exception and with 100,000 votes, that's it. The American people have said consistently, out with the Republicans. And yet here they are in the White House, still there, unelected. And I think that makes them somewhat of a genius, an evil genius. And I think you need to respect your opponent, whether you're in the boxing ring or whether you're General Patton fighting the Nazis. He respected Rommel. He read his books on warfare. He understood him. The other American general was like, why are you reading his books? Because I don't think you can defeat the enemy unless you respect the enemy. Respect? Oh, we don't respect Rommel. Well, you better, because he's about to beat you. You better understand him. And you better realize that you could lose. And we could lose this week. We could definitely lose. And I've been getting up every day with this attitude of, can Trump win? Well, Trump thinks he can win. That's good enough for me. If Trump thinks he can win, that means he can win. Why? Because he's already won. Because he already did it. What makes you think he can't do it again? It's every time in these past 4 years, both of you, I'm sure, have said the same thing I've said. How many times have we said, I can't believe Trump said that. I can't believe he did that. I get that if you maybe have said that in the first 6 months, but if you're still saying that this week, I can't believe he left all those people out in the cold in Nebraska. I can't believe that he treated the woman who's the senator, McSally, in Arizona, that way on the stage. You're saying you can't believe it? you still don't get it after 4 years of this behavior. I think everybody needs to get it. And what I am asking people in these last 24 hours is go to the address book in your mobile phone. Okay. We all have an address book, and start scrolling down and looking for names of people that you think they're good people, but they may not be voting, and call them or text them or send them an email, and do it today, and hold your hand out to them and say, you understand why, you know, the whole thing's a crock of whatever, and why, you know, they're all corrupt and the whole thing, there's no real democracy, et cetera, et cetera.
But brother Michael, I mean, you seem to be saying two fundamental things. One is that we're haunted by the vicious legacy of white supremacy that in part gave us an electoral college. And therefore we ended up with a system in yes. which we can lose our democracy because that system yes. fears democracy.
Yes.
And therefore more and more of our fellow citizens feeling so helpless and hopeless don't even participate in the system. And those who do participate in the system actually win in the popular vote, but can't win with the Electoral College. And if Correct. Trump does lose, he might not leave. He's got enough folk. He's got enough fellow citizens who can yes. try to strike fear in the hearts of people such that yes. we've got civic strife and the system goes down another way. Is that a fair characterization of what you're suggesting, my brother?
Yes, it's exactly it. And I want to mm-hmm. encourage people not to be afraid. Do not yeah. fear. Do not. And there will be intimidation tomorrow. The MAGA trucks will pull up. They will intimidate you while you're in line. You may have already experienced this with early voting. Their bark is much bigger than their bite. They just want you to be afraid, and they think they can make you afraid. And listen, you've been dealing with these types of people since second grade. All right. The bully has always been with us. And while, yes, Trump has told his Second Amendment people to stand by and be ready, the truth of the matter is this. Here's an optimistic view of this country we live in, because it's a factual truth. 78% of our fellow Americans do not own a gun. We know we're a nation of gun nuts, but not really. It's only 3% of our fellow Americans own half the guns. Now, that's scary. So a few million people own about 180 million guns. That's not good. And we know who they are. And we know what their agenda is. But like people in the past, I mean, a lot of the generations, the younger generations, people have not been asked to stand on the Edmund Pettus Bridge. People have not been asked to do any of a number of things. I lost an uncle in World War II. My dad was in the 1st Marine Division all through the South Pacific. God knows what that was like. People have given their lives for this. And just think of all the people. First of all, you had 200 years of slavery before the Civil War, all the atrocities and the madness of that. And then since the Civil War, all the lynchings, all the violence. And it is an act of violence to say you can't vote. It's an act of violence to say you have to work for $5 or $7 an hour. These are all acts of violence, and that so many people have had to go through that and put up with it. What I'm asking everybody to do now in these 24 hours is just take a little time to reach out to otherwise good people who are committing an act of civil disobedience in their minds because they refuse to participate in a corrupt system. That's the good part of the 80 million that don't vote. Right. It's not that they're apathetic. Right. It's not that they're stupid. They care a lot. They care so much. They're willing to give up. They're willing to give up that right that is theirs for this day to have a say, to hold the power.
Yeah, there's something interesting about reframing it that way that I think is important. When people feel despairing and feel like giving up, it's not actually because they don't care. It's that they cared so much that they feel what they want is impossible at this moment. And so yes, it's about focusing on what they originally had hopes for, rather than where they are now. And, you know, the other thing you made me think about was, you know, this 3/5 expansion of the electoral power of Southern states, you know, has been basically repurposed with mass incarceration and reducing the right to vote, right? Another form, you know, of criminal control of Black people's capacity to manipulate, to basically use them to augment state power and to augment white supremacy, and then to retract that power to augment white supremacy. So it's very similar. And I think, you know, so my question sort of flows from that. What would you say about our narrative power? I guess, you know, when I hear you make such compelling points, you know, it never occurred to me that, you know, we were at 80% non-gun owners in the United States, for example. I mean, if I had guessed, I would have said something much less high, right? Yeah. And, you know, yet we've recently had Ilhan Omar on the show, and she had a tremendous power like you do to retell the story in such a compelling way. Why don't we hear these stories more? I have to say, I feel as though these narratives are so powerful. Do you think that there's a real effort to keep them at bay? Or do you think that, I mean, how do you, what's your take on that? Because, you know, I think a lot of this is about storytelling to some degree.
Well, number one, it's fear. Again, let's go back to Dr. West's comment about the fear. The media really needs to, they sell their soap on fear. They want you to believe that we're a nation of gun nuts. When they show those militia types in Michigan, when I look at those guys, you know, and I'm still a Michigander. I know them. I went to high school with them. Don't be afraid of them. They're not. Yes, they're holding guns, but they're doing that because they want to scare you. You know, you want to scare them. You know, across the country in various cities, whatever, the Black Panther Party, the new Black Panther Party has reignited. The last thing they want to see are African-Americans holding guns that they have a right to hold, that they have a right to hold. They have a right to defend themselves. That's the last thing they want. Nobody, I hope, other than a few crazies, and you're always going to have your crazies. You can't do anything about that. There's been crazies since the Greeks. You don't hear this story because the media needs to have you afraid. And the reason you have to be afraid is you have to be thinking constantly so they can sell products that your car's too old, your car's too old, or your hairdo isn't right, or your face is breaking out, or this or that or whatever. And they got to sell products to you, but they can't sell it unless you're afraid of how you look, of what you're driving, of where you live. The other kids are on Windows 10 and my kid's still on Windows 7 and you feel like crap. That's so important. Here's a little example of this. Have you noticed now when they do the weather, especially when they do it on the evening news, on the national news, sometimes it'll take 5 minutes for the weather, something we literally can't do anything about unless we actually want to fix climate change. That would do something. But you know, they're showing us the weather, and then the weather man or woman will then say at the end of the report, you know, and Chuck, this storm that's coming up from Louisiana, and in its path, and they show that big red purple path, 47 million Americans are in danger tonight. They just take the populations of all those states, put them together and go, and 47 million are in the wake of this storm. I mean, what is the point of that? The point is the same point with politics, is that they're trying to scare people and they're trying to have people feel that they are worthless, that they don't count. And why fight City Hall? Because you can't win. So isn't it better to go along so you can get along? That's the message, actually, from the time we're young, because our parents have been through so much. My parents went through the Depression. My dad, again, as I said, World War II, and they didn't have anything. And boy, when they were able to join the middle class, that was like circle the wagons. And that's exactly what they want people to do and to believe. But it's not working. It's not working. And we saw in this great year, and yes, it is a great year, we have lost almost 250,000 people that we didn't need to lose to this virus. And we have seen, continue to see this past week still, police officers believing they are the judge, jury, and executioner of someone whose skin is not white. But When I say great year, I'm talking about how people have responded, not out of fear. People have gone into the streets and they face the tear gas and they face the possibility of violence unto themselves. And that has been so heartening. That isn't going away. That's not going anywhere. And to see white people, to see those, what does Trump call them? The suburban housewives, to see the broad spectrum of the American public out there in the streets this year has been so uplifting to me. And I know it's not going to go away. They have messed up. And you know how they messed up? They could have kept those white suburban people happy just by letting them keep their job and letting them get a good increase every couple of years. So they have a living wage and they're doing fine and the kids are get to go to college and all the things all parents want. But instead, they took it away. They took it away from these white suburban people who were told from the time they were little that this was their country. In their country, they will be able to do X, Y, and Z. You know, speaking about my father, who had to spend a couple of years, parents had to put him in an orphanage because during the Depression, they couldn't afford the seven kids that they had. It's one thing if you've been kept poor and you've never had the things that you should have. You see on TV and you see you know what you're missing, but you don't really know it until you've lived in that nice suburban home where you've never had to worry about a meal on the table, where you know your kids are going to a good school. And now all of a sudden, the system, so greedy, starts to take that away from you. And all of a sudden, you're poor and you're hungry. And I have to say, those people are really, really mad because they know what it's been like to live the good life. And now the system that they believed in, that they voted for, straight Republican, has told them, you know what? You need to give us a little bit more. And by the way, find a new job and get out of our way. They helped to create that mass movement in the streets this year, and that will continue.
No, I think you're absolutely right. But I think what you're also getting at is the way in which this predatory capitalist civilization reinforces the culture of greed, the culture of fear below, with the greed at the top that is out of control and makes it difficult for folk, even when we hit the street, even when we go to jail. It seemingly doesn't have the kind of impact that we would like on the powers that be, so that you end up with a system that more and more lacks legitimacy.
Correct.
And people either withdraw or they hit the streets, they go to jail and they sit back and say, well, wait a minute, they've got the same kind of discourse they had than before, that it seemed as if our efforts have not fundamentally impacted the very ways in which the establishment of the Democratic Party and the folk in the Republican Party, the neoliberals on the one hand and neo-fascists on the other. And yes, we've always said neoliberals are better than neo-fascists. That's not a compliment, but that's a fact. But at the same time, if we're going to stop the march toward fascism, which is very important, I think that's our major priority tomorrow, but also recognizing that the system itself is just so rotten at the core, that there's got to be some major democratic renaissance. It's got to be spiritual, it's got to be moral, it's got to be personal, it's got to be connected to the best of America without being cheaply chauvinistic and connected to the curtailing of the militarism around the world. Now, if we have forces moving in that direction, then we got the legacy of Martin King and the others still working.
Mm. Yes, absolutely right. And the work that we have to do starting Wednesday, once we make sure every vote is counted, because every vote must be counted, otherwise it is not a democracy. So we make every vote is counted. And then the work that we've been doing during these Trump years, the work we've been doing leading up to this election, will look like romper room, will look like kindergarten compared to the work that we have to start immediately. And what I've been saying to people about, you know, with Biden in there, and you and I, Cornel, we've discussed this, and of course, we'd hoped very much for Bernie to have been the candidate. But I have told people, listen, we're going to triple the squad this week. We may quadruple it. We can't leave them alone and not have their back in Congress. We have to be active, and we have to play. This is the good thing about Biden in the White House, assuming this is going to happen. That and we get the Senate back, then we get to play offense. And I would always rather play offense than defense. We've been having to play defense for so long, Cornell, just trying to protect people from the savagery of their own government, of their American corporations. What would 4 years look like if we got to play offense? Meaning we have the ball. So this is going to be about who's carrying the ball and who's going to get to score that touchdown. If we leave the ball simply in the quarterback's hands, in Joe Biden's hands, well, like I said, we'll be back in the Paris Peace Accords. I do believe the minimum wage will go up from $7.25 an hour. We're going to get some good things out of this, but not what we truly need, what you just described, the fundamental changes. But we will, if we are able to play offense, don't you? I mean, I personally, I want to see you with the ball, Cornell. Trisha, I want to see you with it. I want you, Trisha, to be the pass receiver. I want you to be the running back, Cornell. I'll try to grab some fumbles.
No. You're going to be right at the center of the team.
No, I will. No, believe me, I'll be right at the center. And I'll my job will be to prevent fascism from coming back. So, I'm your lineman for that. So,
what we need, need is somebody who can really get that ball across the end zone in that red zone. Because what happens is that when it really comes down to it, right, there's an alignment of people in power across parties who make those changes very difficult. So we might get, pretty far down the field, but it's in the red zone that I worry the most, which is, where the big changes are going to happen. So we're going to need somebody with strong quads and the ability to really, really push. And, we're all going to have to really push together in that end zone, as you often see in football, where everyone just piles in to push that one person across the finish.
Yes. And it may resemble rugby more these next few years, because it looks like you're grappling with your own teammate, and we are going to grapple, but I'm going to trust, and Cornell, I mean, you've been a wonderful, great mentor to me and to millions of others with this sort of thinking that I imagine Joe Biden sitting alone at night in the White House just before bedtime. He doesn't have a bucket of KFC that Trump left behind. They've cleaned all that out. But I got to believe if I were sitting there with him in the evening hours, where the phones aren't ringing, and I think I know that he believes that no human should be prevented from seeing a doctor and getting the exact help they need. I got to believe in his heart, he believes that. So if his heart is already there on this particular issue, that's we're already more than halfway to that goal line. And now it's how do we either convince, nudge, cajole, push, or lift up and carry him across that goal line. Whatever it is we need to do, we have to do it. And we have to organize millions. And I got to believe at some point, a man who has even said this, he may be a one-term president. So he knows he's in his final years of his life, as anybody who's near 80 is. And I got to believe he wants to be remembered for something. Not remembered for what he did in the Senate, 20, 30 years ago, but for how he left America more equitable, everyone covered, everyone having a chance to get whatever education they wanted to get. And I would say to him, that could be your legacy. Okay, you don't want to call it Medicare for all. Fine. Let's call it Medicaid for all. Okay, you don't like that. Let's call it whatever you want. But you know in your heart of hearts and in your conscience that every single American should never have to try to search for a wallet or a checkbook when they're sick. That's evil. and you go to Mass every Sunday, and I grew up like you. I know you're not there for show, going to Mass on Sunday. I know why you're there. I know the progressive tradition of the Catholic Church I was raised in. And I want to speak to your better angels, President Biden, about that, because I think you're going to do a lot of good for us. Here's your moment. Now, I am, of course, in a struggle in that moment with the Wall Street lobbyists, with corporate America, with just the way we humans, especially we guys, as we get older, it's so hard to get us to change, to think differently. Yeah, I'm just, I hope you don't mind, Cornell. I am sharing a secret about our gender.
Brother. We love it. We're going to put the pressure on. People do change.
I got a feeling a few women might have noticed what I'm saying, but I'm just saying.
I mean, that kind of ossified, toxic masculinity that doesn't allow us to see clearly.
Right.
And therefore empathize, because those forces of big pharmaceutical companies and big private insurance companies coming at him too. So now that's why he says he'll veto Medicare for all. Well, he could change his mind, but it depends on what kind of pressure. Depends on how many folk are in the streets and trying to reshape the dialogue. But a lot of it also has to do with personnel, though. Who are the people around him? Who is he listening to? If he's still listening to the same old recycled neoliberals from the Clintonite world and the Obama world, then we need even more serious demonstrations. But, you know, like LBJ, people can change. Now, you don't want to foreclose their capacity to change. But you're right. I think it's going to be another kind of grimness on the other side with Biden. But Biden's going to be at least a blockage of that march to fascism that we have with Trump. I think your point there is a crucial one. But we're in a dark tunnel no matter what.
Yeah, yes. Let me ask both of you a question about, you know, who might be the most viable resources for developing the kind of moral, spiritual vision that Cornell was suggesting is so necessary. I mean, I appreciate, Michael, your hopes that Biden's Catholicism and his genuine, you know, beliefs will help us with that. But I don't think we should per se look to him for that as a primary goal, right? So who can we turn to? Like, who do you, either of you, imagine we could implore? What institutions might help us to push that kind of spiritual narrative forward?
Brother Michael Moore. He's got to turn to Brother William Barber. He's got to turn to the three sisters who played an important role in facilitating Black Lives Matter. He's got to turn to Tef Poe. I mean, there's a whole host of young people who have a variety of different voices. They don't have to speak in the same venue and the same tone and so forth, but he's got to listen to them, because you're talking about, you know, Black folk, over 50% of Black folk have no wealth whatsoever in a country in which it's the wealthiest in the history of the world. He's got to be able to somehow speak to that issue, whatever form it takes. It'd be reparations even might scare some people. No, we got to get some wealth and credit and money to folk who are completely down and out. It's got to be connected to poor people, no matter what color they are, working people, no matter what color they are. But you also have to zero in on the specificity of the level of Black social misery as well. And Sister Kamala Harris has got to be able to listen to some voices outside of her little clique, outside of her little neoliberal clique, who's just reinforcing the same thing. Echoes become echoes. No, you got to have voices. The reason why I started with Brother Michael Moore, I put a smile on his face, but he's got his voice. He's not an echo.
Exactly.
You know, he thinks for himself. He could be critical of fellow leftists because he's got his voice. He ain't your echo, but he's got this heart concerned with working and poor people. That's the kind of folk he got to have around. I don't know whether Biden has that in it, but who knows? Who knows?
Right.
But at the moment, we got to get Trump out. There's no doubt about it.
Yeah, no, for sure.
Yes, I think like the three characters in The Wizard of Oz, the one who lacked a heart, the one who lacked courage and the one who lacked a brain. I think that he has all of those elements already inside of him, but we are the ones that are going to have to mine that gold, to mine that brain and that heart and that courage that is inside of him. I want to start with that thought that he's got it and we've got to bring it out. It won't come out on its own, and it certainly will get crushed by the Wall Street lobbyists and by the wealthy who want to maintain their wealth. And so we're in that struggle immediately. We're already in it. Who I would, to Tricia, to answer your question, I would turn to, without name checking the wonderful organizations that already exist that we know of, when in doubt, I say to people, follow anything, any movement, protest, organization that, if, and again, I don't mean, I can't, I don't like to speak in broad generalities, but generally, we, and I, when I say we now, I need to, I am speaking to the diminishing white majority, which will be gone in the 2040s. So let's get with the program of the new America that is going to save us. And that means an America that is led by women, an America that is led by people of color, an America that is led by young people and the working class. Anything that, look, just look at the, I mean, just the two largest demonstrations in the history of this country, the Women's March in 2017 and the March for Our Lives put together by the Parkland High School kids in Florida. The four women that organized that, the Women's March, and the kids, and I mean kids, I was down there with them. They organized that whole thing, and they were so smart. They wouldn't let anybody over 18 speak on the stage. They said no, and you couldn't see the end of that demonstration. You couldn't see the end of it. It went, there's a million people or more. There's a million people more. I spoke at the Women's March. I couldn't, the pink hats, I couldn't see the end of it. It was just a sea of pink. Mm. It was so powerful. And I, yes, well, here's what happens. Again, no offense to my race or gender here, but when men will just maybe step aside a little bit and let women organize and run, and let young people organize and run, I think we're going to be in good shape. Maybe I'm being too much of a Pollyanna here, but I got to believe that 70% of the people voting this week, 70%, at least of those who are eligible, are either women, people of color, or under the age of 35, or a combination of the three. That's the majority. Mm-hmm. That's our country. And that's why every poll says that 50, 60, 70% of Americans believe in women's choice. They believe the minimum wage should be at least $15 an hour. They believe that college should be free. They believe that we should have universal health care, Medicare for all, whatever you want to call it. The majority of Americans are with us on all of these issues. So we don't have to do that work. When Martin Luther King started, let me just say, I was born the month of Brown versus Board of Education. The majority of the American people were not with Dr. King. Majority at the beginning of the feminist movement, the majority of people were not with Gloria Steinem. The beginning of the gay rights movement, 1969, Stonewall, the majority of Americans were not in favor of that. And now this movement, the majority are already with us. King and Steinem and Larry Kramer, they had such work to do to convince their fellow Americans that this is the righteous thing to do, to support this movement. The anti-war movement that started in 63, it took till almost 72 to finally try to bring this thing to an end. We don't have to do any of that work, is what I'm saying. My friends, the American people are already with us. So now the work is onward to the barricades, to the White House, wherever we got to go, nonviolently. This is our work. If you're able to do it, And we are, because we don't really have a choice, then that is what's in front of us now. Do not, please do not, if Joe Biden is elected president, do not go, oh, finally. Oh,
yeah. Do not take your foot off the gas.
No. Do not. I know it's going to be a human reaction to want to go, you know, I'd be okay if Biden just didn't do anything for maybe a year. Just peace and quiet. I'd like some peace and quiet. Everybody wants peace and quiet. I'm sorry, my friends. The depression isn't over. The war against us isn't over. it continues on. And so we just, you know, yes, let's bring in some new recruits. Let's bring in refresh the troops or whatever, but, you know, or take a break a little bit and then come back. But you, all of us, man, we've got our work cut out for us, Tricia and Cornell.
Yes. Yes, we do.
So true, my brother.
Yes, and you know, since we've been playing so much defense, hopefully we can put the defense, sit them on the bench for a minute and bring on the offense, and that'll be the only break we can get.
It's fun playing offense. You know, I play basketball in junior high school, and I was literally the tallest kid in the Catholic school, but the coach could see that my stamina, my running ability wasn't that great. So he just said to me one day, he said, look, after we make a basket, you don't have to run all the way down to the end. Just cover the back end. Just get across the halfway point.
You were defense for the pass break.
Yes. And then he says, get right back down to that basket. They would just throw me the ball. And I put it in. So whatever role, I mean, obviously it's more fun to play offense. Defense is hard. But I want to tell people listening to this or watching us that it's going to be fun in a way to play offense for once with no illusions. Zion, the player there for the Pelicans, a great college player. He's now in the NBA and he realizes, you know, okay, we're not going to go maybe to the finals in our first couple of years. So it may take a little while, but eventually, I remember, you know, geez, I didn't mean to turn this into a sports show, but people forget the first years of Michael Jordan, because I'm in Detroit and the Pistons were, you know, going to the finals, you know, two or three years in a row, and the Bulls were not, the Chicago Bulls, even though they had Michael Jordan, but they didn't have a team. They didn't have a team yet. And so Jordan was having to score 50 points a game. You can't win that way. You have to have the team. We are all the team. We are all the team, and we all have to, and including the three of us. The three of us, after this week, maybe this coming weekend, we'll have to do our own soul searching and figure out what's our A game. You know, you, me, the three of us, right? What are we going to bring to this? What can we do? I will think about that. I will think seriously. I already am thinking seriously about it. And I know that one thing I want to do to increase the team is I want everybody who's listening to us right now to run for office, to commit to run for office at some point in your life. And some of you need to run in 2022 or 2024. Don't sit it out. Don't think that, no, it's not for you. Well, no, of course it isn't, but you live in a democracy. So it is yours. And each of us have to go on the floor. We have to get off the bench sometime in our life. And then, well, how can all of us run for office? Well, I'll tell you how. When you go in to vote, you see those things where it says precinct captains every 2 years or precinct delegates. It's on the ballot. You know, you could run for that. In most states, you only need 10 to 20 signatures on a petition. Your name could be on a ballot as a precinct delegate. Your only job will be once a year to go to the county convention and send a group of people to the state convention to, like in Michigan, that's where at the state convention, that's where you nominate the Supreme Court justices for the state and a whole bunch of other things and set the party platform. You could have a hand in that just by getting 10 or 20 signatures, getting on the ballot as a precinct delegate. And you can write me and you can say, you know what? I'm now an elected official, because you are. All of us need to think about doing this. And I don't mean you've got to run for president. I mean, you got to run for school board and you've got to run for city council and you've got to run for your neighborhood, whatever.
Yeah.
None of us can sit this out any longer.
Yep. We need everyone. All hands on deck for sure.
All hands on deck. Everybody in the pool.
Well, listen, we don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. We hope that, you know, we can have, you know, a brief reprieve from the onslaught. But we don't know what's going to happen. And so I want to also encourage everybody to, you know, realize that no matter what happens, we have a ton of work to do and a ton of repair work to do. But maybe what we should do is have you on a third time, Michael, for strategies after the election, after all the votes are counted, to see, you know, what we should think about doing.
Let's do that. I'd love to do that with you.
Let's do it.
Let's do it before the inauguration.
Exactly. Because there's no real victory here. It's just strategy, long term planning. Well, it's been fantastic having you here.
Well, it's been great. Thank you for having me back. everybody, please make your voice heard. This is these 24 hours that we're in right now. This is when we hold the most power. We hold all of it in our hands. Trump doesn't hold the power right now. The Wall Street can't write any more checks in the next 24 hours. We hold the power now. And each of us have one vote. And there's more of us than there are of them. And we can actually affect change here. And we can stop the monster. And if you don't think he's a monster still, I want to leave you just with this one last thought. This is the evil genius I try to get into Trump's head. What if he can pull this off? What if he can pull this off? As he had Clarence Thomas standing there swearing in Judge Amy, I thought, wow, you know, it's usually the Chief Justice. It's always the Chief Justice that swears in the new justice. But what is Clarence Thomas doing here? Well, there's been various stories. There's the story I accept. Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, John Roberts, decided he was not going to create a photo opportunity for history of him participating in a sham, him participating in something he knows isn't right, standing on that lawn as part of Trump's reality show. He wouldn't do it. He wouldn't do it. And that's the, again, that's the part where I think to myself, the way I think with Biden, his Catholicism, even though he's on the right, I'm talking about Roberts, even though he's a conservative, at some point, the trigger goes off in the brain and says, this isn't right. I wasn't raised this way. And so in the week leading up to the election, what have we seen? Chief Justice Roberts siding with the liberals on the court before Judge Barrett got on. And even after she got on, because she didn't want to participate yet to do her damage. So the votes were all 4-4, which means the Supreme Court would not hear the decisions and reverse any of the decisions from North Carolina or Pennsylvania. And so here Roberts came in. This is how these little things can happen. He comes in and he does this. But I was watching Trump looking at Clarence Thomas and I thought, oh, wow. Yes, this is how the evil genius works. Trump is saying to himself, I've appointed 3 justices. And this is the 5-year-old in Trump. 3? That's not enough. I want 4. I want 4. I want 4. And they all walk up that balcony. We saw the stairs. They go up. They do the Mussolini balcony moment. And then they went inside. And Clarence Thomas went inside with them. And I thought, oh, my God. Yeah. Trump, it's very possible. I have nothing to back this up, but very possible. Trump is thinking, you know, Justice Thomas, you are 72 years old. And I don't mean to be critical, but you look like you're 82. And these Democrats are going to win. They're going to have the White House for 8 years. You're going to be in your 80s. They're going to get to pick your replacement. And if they get 8 years, they could get another 8. And it could be 16 years and you'll be in your 90s. I need you to resign. I need you to do this after the election, because we will have 59 days between the election and when the Democrats take over the Senate on January 3rd. And we legally and constitutionally have the right to put a new justice on the Supreme Court in that time period. And your legacy will be that you allowed me to do that. And I don't mean to end this podcast by sending a chill down everyone's spine. But if we've learned anything in these 4 years, it's that anything is possible. And there is no shame in Trump or any of these Republicans. They will do whatever they can to grab more power. And the idea of having a 7-2 Supreme Court, because they legally can do it between now and January 3rd, don't put it past them. Don't put anything past them. Even with Biden winning, we have a dangerous time between Election Day and Inauguration Day, because Trump can still do a lot of things.
We're talking so much about racial identity, gender identity. If it's not tied to deep moral integrity and tied to a solidarity that's connected with the least of these, and poor and working people, you can get a black man, you can get a woman up there, and they can be just as reactionary as a white man. And so we've got to ground our talk about identity and the integrity and broad solidarity, or we'll fall into the same cycle. And this is true for neoliberals as well as the neo-fascists.
Right. That's right.
The spiritual and the moral dimension can never be reduced and never be pushed aside.
That's so important, Cornell, because not only does it help us understand that half of white women voted for Trump, but it also helps us understand that white men can be allies to anybody. And that includes a progressive, you know, movement. And so, you know, this, it's not about what body you come in, what color skin you come in. It's, you know, who are your allies? Who are you in alignment with? And that's critical. I couldn't agree more with that. Right.
And yes. Brother Michael Moore is a living example.
Living
look at his heart, his courage, his vision, his willingness to serve the least of thee.
And the sacrifices. I mean, there's a ton of...
Absolutely. We ain't got to the brilliance and the artistry yet. We couldn't talk about the films today. We just talked about politics. But it has to do with one's humanity. It has to do with one's humanity. That's the bottom line.
Right. But that's why the power of storytelling to remind people of who they are, tell them what they need to be focusing on. You've been on the forefront of this for decades, Michael, and it's been so important. You've taken on the hardest issues and made people, you know, really feel welcome in rethinking what they thought they knew. So hats off to you. We're going to need you in this next quarter, though. The game is still on. So
the game is on until noon of January 20th. And there are things that are going to happen between now and that day that we can't even imagine because we don't have the mind of we're not evil geniuses.
Right. We want the institutions to follow a protocol. They have no investment in that. It's called how do you actually tear this to the ground and take, you know, extract the copper pipes out of this joint. Basically, we're down to, you know, what you do when, you know, foreclosures are in process. Well, anyway, let's not get too down and out.
Thank you for having me on. This has been a real honor in this final day that I get to spend it with the two of you. It's I'll always remember how I spent the last day of the Trump era. And then I got to do it with you guys. It means a lot to me. My spirits are boosted and I have a lot of faith in all the people that are listening and watching us, that we are going to persevere and we are going to create a better world. There is no other choice. And I know that the majority of my fellow Americans are good and decent people, have a conscience, have a heart, and will do the right thing. I'm going to go to bed tonight on that thought.
Well, thank you very much. I'll sleep much better than I would have otherwise. Thank you, brother.
Thank you.
Well, no matter what happens, I love you, Brother Michael. Love you, Sister Trisha. And we're going to just keep swinging in the name of justice, regardless of the circumstances. But we shall see. We shall see.
All right. Thank you so much, Michael Moore, for joining us, our inaugural repeat guest. And we're looking forward to the trifecta sometime in a few weeks. And thank you all for joining us on the Tightrope. You know, we'll be back shortly and we hope you'll sign up and subscribe and do all that YouTube stuff, you know, that they say we should do. And we'll see you again on the Tightrope as soon as possible. Take care now.
There she is on the 40-yard line. Trisha's got the ball. Trisha's on the 35. She's on the 30. She's on the 25. Here comes Cordell West. There, she throws the ball. He throws the ball to Cornell. Cornell's on the 20-yard line, the 15, the 10, the 5, the 2. Wait a minute. He's on the 2-yard line, and he's doing an end zone dance on the 2-yard line. No! Cornell, go across the line!
Michael, push him in! Michael, push him in!
Martin King, Ella Fitzgerald, and Ella Baker.
That's right.
Exactly.
Thank you for that.
Hello, my tightrope brothers and sisters. I want you to join us on election night for our live watch party with some very special guests, and they include Marion Williamson, Bhaskar Sunkar from Jacobin Magazine, Eddie Glaude, Ashley Woodard Henderson, Kashama Sawant, and Father Flager from Chicago. That's the south side of Chicago. And Christian Scott, grand jazz musician. Go to our YouTube channel on the Tightrope Pod and set a reminder so we can notify you when we're going live. See you Tuesday night.